Srimad Bhagavatam, First Canto, Chapter 2, Text 19. Tada rajas tamo bhava kamo lobha dayashchaye cheta etar anabhidam stitam sattve prasidati. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. As soon as irrevocable loving service is established in the heart, the effects of nature's modes of passion and ignorance, such as lust, desire, and hankering, disappear from the heart. Then the devotee is established in goodness, and he becomes completely happy. Therefore, a living being, in his normal constitutional position, is fully satisfied in spiritual bliss. This state of existence is called Brahma Bhuta or Atma Nandi, or the state of self-satisfaction. This self-satisfaction is not like the satisfaction of the inactive fool. The inactive fool is in the state of foolish ignorance, whereas the self-satisfied Atmanandi is transcendental to the material state of existence. This stage of perfection is attained as soon as one is fixed in irrevocable devotional service. Devotional service is not inactivity, but the unalloyed activity of the soul. The soul's activity becomes adulterated in contact with matter, and as such, the diseased activities are expressed in the form of lust, desire, hankering, inactivity, foolishness, and sleep. The effect of devotional service becomes manifest by complete elimination of these effects of passion and ignorance. The devotee is fixed at once in the mode of goodness, and he makes further progress to rise to the position of Vasudeva, or the state of unmixed sattva, or shuddha sattva. Only in this shuddha sattva state can one always see Krishna eye to eye by dint of pure affection for the Lord. A devotee is always in the mode of unalloyed goodness, therefore he harms no one. But the non-devotee, however educated he may be, is always harmful. The devotee is neither foolish nor passionate. The harmful, foolish, and passionate cannot be devotees of the Lord. However, they may advertise themselves as devotees by outward dress. A devotee is always qualified with all the good qualities of God. Quantitatively, such qualifications may be different, but qualitatively, both the Lord and his devotee are one and the same. Om agyanate madandasha gunanjana shalakaya chakshur militam yena tasmai shri gurave namah. So there is really a huge, huge wealth of extremely valuable information in this purport, Srila Prabhupada. Many, many, many very deeply significant points are being made here. One is, persons who advertise themselves as devotees by dressing as devotees. This is a warning to us in our ISKCON movement. Simply putting on a dhoti and tilak or a sari, you know, and a neck beads and a seeker or whatever doesn't make you a devotee. You can't just, you know, go through the external motions and actually become a devotee. One has to give up acting in a way that is harmful to others. One has to give up acting in a way that is foolish. And one has to give up acting in a way that is passionate. Not only acting, but the speech also has to be devoid of passion, devoid of foolishness, and devoid of harmfulness. And ultimately that means one's mind has to be free from a harmful attitude, free from a foolish attitude, and free from a passionate attitude. Otherwise it will come out in your speech and your activities. This being considered to being that devotee, nice devotee. Everyone thinks, oh, he's a nice devotee. You know, just even to have a good reputation amongst the devotees is not really enough. One has to become completely purified. Another point is that in the Shuddhasattva state, one can always see Krishna eye to eye at every minute. Someone may question, well, what mode am I in? Am I in Shuddhasattva? And then we can simply ask, are you seeing Krishna eye to eye at every minute? At every minute, are you perceiving Krishna eye to eye? Yes or no? If the answer is no, then you're still contaminated by the modes of nature. Because the person who has become completely free of the contaminating influence of sattva-gun, rajagun, tamagun can directly perceive God face to face, eye to eye, always, as Prabhupada says here, always, always. How is one able to do so? Is simply being free of the modes itself sufficient? No, actually. The Mayavadi impersonalist may temporarily become free from the influence of the modes, but he's still not qualified to see Krishna face to face. So Prabhupada explains this by dint of pure affection for the Lord. So this we have to understand is the goal of everything that we're doing in our Krishna consciousness movement. You have to feel an affection for God. You have to love God. Therefore, impersonalism doesn't work. You can't love the impersonal Brahman. It's not lovable. You can't feel affection for something that doesn't have a form, doesn't have a name, doesn't have any activities, doesn't have any qualities, etc., etc., etc. How you can feel affection for this thing? Not possible. Therefore, we have to understand that God indeed is a person. He has activities, he has likes, he has dislikes. Just like sometimes people say, well, you know, what could be wrong with eating onions and garlic? I mean, there's no medical thing for it. Medically, they're not harmful. They say, I can understand that caffeine is bad, medically. But onions and garlic actually have medicinal value. Some people take them for health purposes. They have even garlic pills you can take. So what could be wrong with doing that? It's how can you possibly say it's wrong? But they don't understand the principle of love of God. That if you truly love the Lord, you won't eat anything unless it's first offered to Him, because that's the instruction He gives. Yajna-shishta-shana-shanto muchante sarvakil-vishai. He's giving an order in the Bhagavad Gita. The devotee only eats the remnants of what's offered to me. And Krishna has made it very clear He doesn't eat onions and garlic. So because they're addicted to onions and garlic, they don't want to accept this principle. But the fact is, if you love someone, you wouldn't want to feed them something they hate. If you love, just like we are guests in your home, and you want to please us. And we said, you know, we really hate we hate strawberries. You know, if we get allergic reaction, I get sick if I eat strawberries. And they say, well, we would like to offer you strawberries. And this, if you really, you know, this is our love for you, is to feed you strawberries. Of course, then don't worry, I can take strawberries. It's an example. But If you love someone, you're not going to do, you want to please them. So therefore, we give up on Yajnavalkya because Krishna hates them. Actually, any person who's not accustomed to eating onions and garlic will find that they stink. Even when we go to the grocery store, you know, shopping, you go by the onions and the garlic and it's just like, oof, it's a horrible stink. Someone who's addicted to it, they think, oh, this is heaven. Onions and garlic, they just want to take a deep breath. It's like smokers, you know. They'd love to go into a smoke-filled room. Ah, this is heaven. You see, the very non-smokers, oh my God, let me get out of here so my clothes will stink by this horrible atmosphere. So we have to understand the Lord does not like onions and garlic, and if we actually love him, we won't think, well, why doesn't he accept onions and garlic? What's his problem anyway? Doesn't he know that I like them? And if I'm going to be a devotee, then I have to eat only prasadam. So what's his problem that he won't accept onions and garlic? Why doesn't he accommodate me by taking onions and garlic so I can have it as prasadam? They find fault with God. What's his problem? Why doesn't he know that onions and garlic are healthy? But if you really love someone, your own likes and dislikes don't matter anymore. Even Lord Jesus, who's a Prabhupada affirms, a pure Vaishnava. Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati, of course, said he's a Shaktivesh avatar. He expresses this mood of pure bhakti. He says, Father, not my will, but thy will be done. So that is the mood. Not what I want, but what does God want? So this is a very significant point. If you want to enjoy the ultimate darshan of being able to see Krishna at every minute, you want to taste the sweetest pleasure of virtually entering into the spiritual world, even in this present body, then you have to develop pure affection for the Lord. And what does pure affection mean? What's the difference between affection and pure affection? In this material world, many, many people are affectionate. You know, the boyfriend and the girlfriend are very affectionate to one another. But is that pure affection? No. It's impure affection. Because it's based on the principle of I will scratch your back if you scratch mine. Mutual sense gratification. That is not pure affection. Pure affection means that I give everything for you and I want nothing in return except for the opportunity to continue to serve you. You see? That's the only thing the devotee wants. He just begs for the opportunity to be able to continue engaging in service. He doesn't ask for anything else. That's called pure affection. No thought of anything in return. So there's a wealth of other very wonderful points here. A living being is naturally, constitutionally blissful. As we quoted last night, Anandamayo Vyasa Vedanta Sutra. By nature, the living being is jolly. He's blissful. If you're not feeling jolly at this very minute, or at any minute, you are doing something wrong. You see? You're doing something wrong. If you don't feel jolly right now, you're doing something wrong. You're not connecting with your actual self. You're off on some tangents. You see, you're not centered properly. You're not centered in your actual spiritual identity. You're out there on the far reaches of the out there hovering in the material nature somewhere, far away from your actual spiritual identity. So Krishna consciousness is the process of getting back to where you once belong, actually, getting back to your actual position. Jivara Sarupa Hai Krishna Anachyadas. Now here there's a sharp contrast being made by the divine grace. Srila Prabhupada, between the bliss of the karmi and the bliss of the self-satisfied, self-realized Atmanandi. It's a gulf of difference. We see many people, especially in America, it's very common for people to think that they're happy. Some devotees went out, I saw the video footage of it, they went out on the street and they interviewed people. Almost everyone said they're happy. Only one person, practically only one person said, yeah, I'm... only one person said he wasn't happy. He was, I forget what he said, but he expressed his... I'm grouchy today, feeling grouchy, complaining mood. But practically everyone is saying, oh yeah, I'm the happiest person, I'm so-and-so, I worked down the street in this office, I had a big position there, and blah, 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 on and on. Simply, they're thinking they're very happy. So the question is, what's wrong with them? The people are feeling a sense of happiness in this material world. Why should we mess with that? Why not just let them go on in their happiness? You know, they say to each his own. Do whatever makes you happy. That's the common philosophy. So if you're happy by Krishna consciousness, that's okay for you. And I'm happy by, you know, making money and drinking beer and having sex every night with my girlfriend. That's what makes me happy. So, you know, why are you Hare Krishna is making such a beef about, you know, illicit sex and meeting, intoxication and gambling? Don't you realize that, you know, I have my kind of happiness and you have yours? To each his own. Why are you bothering me? You're like the born again Christians. Bible, you know, they bash me on the head with the Bible and you're bashing me on the head with the Bhagavad Gita. Why are you harassing me? You can go chant Hare Krishna in your temple and I'll, you know, have barbecue, beer, and illicit sex. Let me enjoy my life. Why are you harassing me? You see, that was said. So the question is, what is the happiness of such a person? Described here, the inactive fool, foolish ignorance. Of course, there's also the passionate fool, actively engaged in a foolish way. So what is that actually the reality? They have some, there is material pleasure. However, it is a feverish pleasure, as we described yesterday. It's tinged by the anxiety of knowing that it will go away sooner or later. And we see that it's always being interrupted by so many things. That's a fact. Their happiness is being interrupted by so many things. This material world, your happiness can be taken away at any minute. Look how much the people in Gaza are happy right now with all the fighting going on there, the Israelis invading Gaza, or look what's happening in Baghdad. How do we know that won't happen here? What if Al-Qaeda takes over America? You see. What happens if we're thinking we're very happy in America. What happens if Al-Qaeda gets everything necessary to produce a nuclear bomb? And they assemble it in New York City. And they call up the president and say, okay, we're going to blow up New York City unless you accede to our demand. We want to take over your country, make it an Islamic country. Everyone has to become a Muslim in the U.S. And Islamic law has to be introduced to them. You either accept this or we will wipe New York City off the map in the next 5 minutes. And they've actually put together the nuclear bomb to do that. Many say it's just a matter of time before they have the power to do that. Many experts are saying it's just a matter of time. There's so many rogue states getting nuclear capabilities now. Now North Korea has just launched. They have a missile that can actually reach the U.S. Their test didn't work, but sooner or later they will work successfully, and they have a missile that can actually hit the U.S. with a nuclear warhead. So, we may think we're happy now, but all hell can actually break loose on this planet, and civilization as we know it can become completely destroyed. The U.S. could be like another Baghdad. The only thing that's preventing it now is karma. It just so happens that people in this country have some very pious karma that enabled them to have a heavenly, you know, relatively speaking, a heavenly type of existence compared to other places on this planet. But what are they doing with all of the good karma they have? They're slaughterhouses, illicit sex, they're breaking all the principles. This Krishna consciousness movement is actually is the saving grace of America and every country on the face of this planet. The fact that they go on engaging in all sorts of sinful activities mean they are simply begging chaos and utter destruction of the deterioration of the civilization to become more and more manifest. This Krishna consciousness movement is actually the only hope for this planet. There was one poet, poet Yeats, he wrote a very nice poem. It wasn't perfect because there was no Krishna consciousness. We had a very good analysis of the material world. He said, things fall apart, the center cannot hold, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. That's where we're heading. He noted it, must have been over 100 years ago. That's actually what's happening. The center cannot hold because they haven't put Krishna there. If we want the center to actually hold, we have to put Krishna in the center. Therefore, the bona fide spiritual master, he is very keen and very eager to introduce this principle to all the world leaders. That we must put God in the center, whether you call him Krishna or Allah or Jehovah, that's alright. But we must put God in the center. Not a impersonal God or not simply an order supplier God, but a God that we surrender unto fully. As a bona fide spiritual master, he wants to educate all the leaders of the world that we must put God in the center, and that will solve the problems of the world. But they are so carried away by lust, by anger, by greed, that they can't hear. They can't hear. And therefore the world is on the risk of complete breakdown of the social order. Complete, and you know, anarchy. And it will come at the end of Kali Yuga. It will just be the law of the jungle at that time. The whole human civilization will be reduced to the size of pygmies, and they will all be cannibals. It'll be I'll eat you or you eat me. Whoever is the fastest with a knife wins. So, this Krishna consciousness movement is actually what can save the world if the people will take it. But the bottom line is this, at least we can be saved. Krishna personally protects anyone who surrenders unto him. We never have to fear that something outside of the plan of Krishna will happen to us if we're fully surrendered to him. Actually, even if you're not surrendered to Krishna, everything is always happening according to Krishna's plan. Everyone is under Krishna's plan. But the good news is you can choose which plan. He has two plans, plan A and plan B. You can choose which program do I want to be on, the material nature or the spiritual nature. You have a choice. You want to attend the university or the state penitentiary? Just like they have in Pennsylvania, there's a university called Penn State. So you can either attend Penn State or the State Pen. Penn is also an abbreviation for penitentiary. So you can go to Penn State or the State Pen. Which do you prefer? the intelligent person thinks, why should I, you know, be breaking rocks in the prison when I can become a spiritually enlightened being? Attend, you know, Hare Krishna University, ISKCON University. ISKCON is now affiliating with some accredited, you know, university, so ISKCON can be accredited in the eyes of the karmic world. They are Radhadesh, and they have some affiliation. So you can actually get an accredited degree now in theology, something like that. Some kind of Vaishnava. You actually get a degree, accredited degree there. But the real success of our movement, it will be when the major universities have to be accredited by ISKCON to be recognized as legitimate. When Harvard has to apply to ISKCON for accreditation, Yale, Oxford, Cambridge, they have to apply to ISKCON for accreditation. Be recognized as bona fide educational institutions. That will be the real success of our movement. Of course, it's a great success that we're accredited by them now, but actually that's nothing compared to the ultimate goal, which is that they have to be accredited by us. That's the real success of our society. For the government to be recognized as legitimate, they have to be accredited by ISKCON. That will be the real success. Now, you know, we're begging, you know, we apply, we want to incorporate in the U.S., you know, it's a whole thing. You apply to the IRS to get, you know, to be recognized as a church with a tax exemption. You know, we're just hoping they'll approve us, you know. But it actually should be the other way around. The government should be hoping that ISKCON will approve it so they can actually govern and rule. That's the real success. So we, you know, we got a long way to go for establishing this movement on this planet. But this kind is actually meant to be the leading educational and managerial society on this planet. Government leaders should all be managing their countries under the direction of our ISKCON movement. That's actually, you know, the goal, one of our goals. So anyway, we can open it up now if there's any questions.
Just listening to one of my colleagues in the office, and they said that...
Listening to what?
Listening to...
In my office, to my colleagues, and they said that George Bush said that God sort of, told him to attack Iraq. So when we have this kind of nonsense philosophies, or it just seems that it is, when you say that we want ISKCON to give approval to governments, when we have such demoniac governments, how do we
You have to spread Krishna consciousness. You have to make we can't take the government by force. We have to take the government by democratic vote. That means we have to educate the people in general. That means we have to make everyone devotees. We have to turn the general public to this movement. We have to preach. We have to distribute Prabhupada's books. We have to do Harinam Sankirtan. We have to put on Ratha Yatra festivals. We have to distribute prasadam. We have to cultivate persons that we are in contact with. We have to preach. That's the bottom line. As much as possible, we have to read Prabhupada's books, chant Hare Krishna, and preach. This is the formula. As much as possible, read, chant, and preach. And in this way, the Krishna consciousness movement will inundate the entire world like a gigantic tsunami. We have to really read these books and understand what Prabhupada is saying. We have to do a lot. We have to chant very attentively the Hare Krishna mantra without offense. And we have to preach as much as we possibly can to everyone that we meet. That's why I like to travel everywhere in a dhoti. I travel all over the world. I don't even have a pair of pants in my suitcase. All I have is dhotis. Well, actually, when I went to the Middle East, I had to break my rule. And had on our last round, but that's an exception. I have to go into a Muslim country to clear customs in a Muslim country. to make it easier to get in. Devotees told me I had to do that, so I did that under their direction. But it's a general rule, wherever I go, I'm just, you know. Because it gives us facility for preaching. When people recognize, they see, oh, here's a monk, here's a religious man. Then it gives them some scope that, or they may approach and ask some questions. So in this way, we always want to be preaching as much as we possibly can to everyone we meet. That's the way to do it. We have to be very aggressive pushing toward this Krishna consciousness movement to make everyone a devotee. This is not proselytizing. This is mercy, actually. They're dying. Their so-called religious systems, whether it's Hinduism, Christianity, Muslim, Islam, whatever, you know, it's they're hurting themselves. In the name of spiritual life, they're going to hell, actually. We have to understand that outside of this Krishna consciousness process, there's no hope. There's no alternative, really. There's no alternative. That's confirmed by the Sri Upanishad. There's no alternative to this way for man. This way of complete devotion to the Supreme, that is Krishna consciousness. Outside of this complete total devotion to the Supreme Person, there's no hope for anyone. We'll never be happy. And their so-called religious systems are not practically, maybe theoretically, but in practice they are not based on complete devotion to the Supreme Person. They're not. They're based on I, me, and mine. It'll make you feel so fine. Questions, Mark?
Prabhuji, does Krishna know our free will?
Does Krishna
know our free will?
Does he know? Yeah, Krishna knows everything. Some say, well, if Krishna knows what you're going to do, that means he's controlling it, but that's not true. Krishna is omniscient and he's omnipotent. So because he has unlimited power, he has the power to know what you will do and at the same time give you complete freedom to do what you want. It's inconceivable from mundane logic, but actually, if you accept the fact that God is omnipotent, he has unlimited power, he can do anything, and he knows everything, he's omniscient, then it's not at all difficult for Krishna to give you the choice to either do this or do that, to change your mind, and to know exactly what you're going to do. Some people say, well, if he knows what you're going to do, that means he's actually controlling your decision. He's not giving you free will if he actually knows what you're going to do, but that's not true. Krishna has the power to give you complete free will at the same time to know exactly what you're going to do, how you're going to use your free will. Just like you can give your dog free will, do what it wants, and you throw a bone, you know what he's going to do. When you throw a bone, you know what will happen. He'll run for that bone. Well, he doesn't have to. But the dog, he'll run for that bone. Even though he's free to do whatever he wants, you know he'll run for that bone. Questions, Mark?
Would you, regarding the Varnashram Dharma, which is what's applicable, like, you know, for the previous ages, but nowadays...
Okay, what was it?
Varnashram Dharma.
Okay.
So, nowadays, it is not fully applicable. I mean, internally, there are still, like, you know, four classes of people, but there's no thing like, you know, worker class, which is exclusively working, or, like, Vaishyas, and also Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said that, you know, Varnashram Dharma is external. So is like in the sense that externally not being followed and the path of bhakti followed is the ultimate, like, you know, we need not follow or, like, you know, have a society based on those principles.
Well, When your leg is broken, you use crutches, don't you? And when your leg heals, you don't need the crutches anymore. Another example is when the airplane's taking off, the wheels have to be down. And once you're up in the air, you can lift the wheels in. So as long as you're the airplane is on the ground, the wheels have to be out. So the wheels, that is varnashram. Once you're off the ground, then you don't need the wheels anymore. You don't need varnashram. If you're in pure bhakti, you don't need varnashram. But if you're not in pure bhakti, you need varnashram. Simple thing. Just like the wheels of the airplane. Actually, we see varnashram principles is even there in Srila Vyasadeva. And Sukadev Goswami was completely... even the external aspect was there. Sukadev Goswami, when he came out of the womb, he went running, not to get entangled in household life. And he came by the young girls who were bathing naked. And... they could see he's a Paramahamsa. Like, he's like a little baby boy. He's just like a little baby. He was had the innocence of like a little baby. So they didn't bother to cover their bodies. They were completely naked. Here's a young 16-year-old boy. But they didn't, he was naked. They were naked. And they didn't think anything of it. They could see he's just like a little baby, you know, completely not seeing male or female. So they didn't even bother to cover themselves. But then when his father came by, even though he's a literary incarnation of God, he's fully self-realized, but he's acting in the role of a householder. Immediately went running for cover. You see. So that's varnashram in action. Covering a woman, covering her body, that's varnashram. If you're completely transcendental, then you don't even need body. You don't even. You can be a Nagababa. You can go naked. You see, like Shukadev.
So
the fact that we clothe our bodies, that's an aspect of varnashram. We're recognizing male female. You see, male female. That's also an aspect of varnashram. Recognize that there's male and females going around here. Ultimately, we're not male or female, but we have to act in that capacity to protect ourselves from being degraded. So Varnashram, you know, acknowledges that we're still conditioned by lust, anger, and greed, and we have to act in such a way we don't become degraded. We have to act in such a way we become elevated. Questions more?
So these Nagababas, they come to the Kumbh Mela, are they very highly elevated people?
Not necessarily. Some of them could be. I mean, there are very exalted souls who come down to Kumbh Mela, but just because someone is a Nagababa, I mean, if that was the case, then they had these hippie gatherings of rainbow people, rainbow festival, they would all be great Paramahamsas because they run around naked. Simply becoming a nudie doesn't make you a Paramahamsa. Don't misunderstand. Actually, one who goes naked, Makarmi goes naked, they'll become trees in their next lifetime. I remember one time we were on the University of Florida campus, we were preaching there, and all of a sudden we heard a whistle blow. It used to be a big popular thing on the campus back in the early 70s, they called it streaking. So that some couple of people just came running across the campus completely naked, you know. So the police, they ran so fast, the police, it happened so quick, the police didn't catch them. It was like a, you know, an expression of freedom. They went somewhere where they had a planned place to go where they could get, put some clothes on and vanish into some building so no one would know where they were and they wouldn't get a ticket or get caught. It happened so fast, you know. So does that mean that they're great Paramahamsas? because they're streaking on the college campus, running nude across the Plaza of the Americas? No. Questions more? Question?
I'm wondering, like, we're supposed to be, like, able to tolerate anything on our own behalf. Right.
Anything on...
on our own behalf. Like, anything that happens to us on our own, like...
offenses committed to us, one should tolerate, and
not being treated properly, etc. Like, on our own behalf, it's fine. Like, we can tolerate that. Like, right?
Tolerate what?
Tolerate the offenses committed towards oneself.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
But if we see other devotees not being treated properly, and, like, we shouldn't tolerate that. So, like...
if other devotees are being offended?
Yeah.
That's
like,
right. We should not. That's right.
So, what can we do? Like, if we see this happening, like, if we see people aren't being treated properly, and,
you just gotta do something to stop it.
So, like, what? Like, what can you do? Like...
well, at least you should know what... at least you understand what's proper and what's improper, so that when you are in a position to do something about it, you can do something about it. If you can't do anything about it...
leave the place, right?
Let me explain.
Okay, I'm asking.
Even in mundane time management seminars, they teach this principle. And it works. This principle works very well in Krishna consciousness. You have to understand... There are two aspects to reality, okay? One aspect of reality is that aspect of reality that you have the ability to control what's happening. You have power of influence in one arena of reality. There's another arena of reality in which you have no control. So you have to know the difference between the two arenas. In that arena where you have control, you have to utilize your power to its fullest extent. And in that arena where you have no power, you just got to tolerate it.
But
now, though, the arenas can shift also. You can actually, and this is not one of those insider secrets, that to the degree of your purity, that arena under which you have control will expand more and more and more. That's one of the insider secrets. To the extent of your purity, you will gain more power and more influence on this planet. In fact, it is stated by Srila Prabhupada that a devotee who is absolutely pure in their chanting without any offense, they actually can inspire or influence the entire world to take up Krishna consciousness. So if you can't do anything externally about offenses that are being committed towards a devotee, especially your spiritual master, then you should just try to purify yourself more and more and more, so you'll have more power in the future to do something. Not only your spiritual master, but especially your spiritual master.
Isn't it said also,
huh?
Isn't it, there is three things one does it, if one hears or sees the offensive thing, then either one leaves that place or try to defeat the offenses.
Yes, that is stated also. Nectar Devotion gives some. In one place it says you should cut out their tongue, which we don't advise that you do that in this age. In fact, I'm forbidding you to do that. Don't wield a knife and cut out the tongue of anyone who's blasphemous. Don't do that. Don't even think about doing it. That is not... Prabhupada also talks about the proper application of rules and regulations.
Yes.
That rule is not applicable now. It's not the yuga in which we can do that. If someone is blaspheming a Vaishnava, you defeat them by argument. Somehow or other, you convince them not to do that. Maybe you can charm them out of it also. I mean, you know, diplomacy. Somehow or other, you can get them to stop doing that. That's the ideal thing. If that's not possible, then you can commit suicide. rather than hearing such blasphemy. And if that's not practical, then you shouldn't get out of there. Actually, I'm giving you an order, don't commit suicide. But it is mentioned in the scriptures like that. Do not commit suicide. That just makes the point of how bad it is. It's better to commit suicide than to hear blasphemy. That's how dangerous blasphemy is.
Well, sometimes it's not so much blasphemy, it's just lack of respect in general. Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, by yourself showing a very good example of respect, by yourself being an ideal example of someone who respects Vaishnavas, that can influence others when they see how much respect you are offering, and when they can see that actually, I mean, let's say for example, you become highly advanced, you get off the neophyte platform that you're hovering on right now, and you become a highly advanced devotee who's just like, you know, very advanced in Krishna consciousness. And then you show the example of being very respectful to Vaishnavas, and people go, wow, this Mataji Vishnupriya, I mean, Vishnupriya is already there, but I'm saying this Radhapriya Devi Dasi, she's so blissful, but we see she's so respectful. Maybe if we become respectful like Radhapriya is, we can also taste that sort of nectar, you see. This is called acharya, when he teaches by example. So right now, you may be described as a bumbling idiot, at least in many of the things that you do, you see. But you really need to become an acharya, because that will enable you to have a powerful impact on the world society, the ISKCON society. If a devotee becomes an acharya within ISKCON, truly, not just in name, but truly an acharya, that has an impact on other devotees. Are actually open to being influenced by other devotees. We all want to advance in Krishna consciousness. And if we see an advanced devotee, whether he's our guru or he's somebody else's guru, you know, and it doesn't matter. If there's an advanced devotee who has developed divine qualities, and we are serious about advancing spiritually, we'll become just like, I'm so enlivened to associate with my godbrothers, my senior godbrothers, because I'm uplifted by their association. So you need to become advanced in Krishna consciousness, and then people will feel how they're being uplifted by your association. You see? So that's how you can actually influence people. By your example, become an acharya. You can influence thousands and millions of people if you become an acharya. Develop the mood, the speech, and the actions of an acharya. That's a direct instruction you just got from your spiritual master. Become an acharya. And then you can influence thousands and millions of people to become very, very respectful. That's the most important thing. We have it in our spiritual life. The most important thing is we have to give all respect to Vaishnavas. If we don't, that's why people leave Krishna consciousness, because they didn't have a proper attitude towards Vaishnavas. They became disrespectful to Vaishnavas. Anyone who is disrespectful to Vaishnavas, their days as a devotee are numbered, or even they're already gone. They're just making you sure they're dressing as a devotee. Actually, anyone who's not respecting Vaishnavas is not really a devotee. Even though they may dress like one, they're not a devotee. And we see these splinter groups that have left ISKCON. They are full of disrespect for Vaishnavas. So their Krishna consciousness is a show only. Someone who is actually Krishna conscious is highly respectful of all Vaishnavas. Highly respectful of all Vaishnavas, of all living beings, even of a little ant. Is it? Questions more?
Probably if there are two devotees and both of them are senior to you and they're having a conflict before you, then what is the attitude that we should...
Well, you could take sides and fight with one against the other. But that's not... That's not the best. You have to think, this conflict must be transcendental. Prabhupada says in his purport that sometimes among devotees there is a difference of opinion, but that difference of opinion is spiritual. And if they're getting guns out and they're getting ready to shoot, then, you know, that's another matter. But if they're simply, you know, disagreeing with each other as two gentlemen, then you just have to think, well, if one of them happens to be your spiritual master, then you just side with your spiritual master and think, but I don't want to think ill about someone who disagrees with them. It must be a transcendental controversy. But I will side with my Guru Maharaj, but I won't think ill about the person who disagrees with him. Because they are God brothers and they have a right to disagree with each other. Now we should think, well, my Guru Maharaj is pure and this other one's an envious snake. We should think they're both pure, but they're just having... Even in Prabhupada's books, we see the acharyas. This was when I was a new bhakta, I couldn't understand, because Prabhupada says in the Bhagavatam purport that the Yajur Veda is the additional Veda. And then in a Back to Godhead magazine, in a lecture, he said the Atharva Veda is the additional Veda. And anyone who has any common sense understands that it has to be only one original Veda. So how they get both the original Veda? And I was bewildered to understand this. So I asked my Vartma Pradarshika Guru, who made me a devotee, Vishnu Janamaraj. And he gave me a very transcendental answer, which temporarily satisfied me. He said they're both the original Veda. Of course, it doesn't make sense from a mundane point, but... I thought, well, that's transcendental. You just have to have faith. They must. If Prabhupada said, this is the original Veda, and that's the original Veda, then you have to have faith in the words of Prabhupada, even though it doesn't make any sense. You just have faith that they're both the original Veda. And I didn't let it bother me anymore. It's just barely transcendental. But then later on, in a purport, in the later canto of the Bhagavatam, Prabhupada says, according to some Vaishnava authorities, the Yajur Veda is the original Veda. And according to other Vaishnava authorities, the Atharva Veda is the original Veda. So even amongst the great Vaishnava Acharyas, there's sometimes differences of opinion on details. The essential things, there's never any difference of opinion. So if even the great Acharyas are disagreeing about what the original Veda is, should I get hung up in a... Should I become disturbed by that disagreement? Actually, having heard that Prabhupada said both things, I can give you a lecture. Like lecture today, I can say, yes, according to the original Veda, the Yajur Veda, blah, 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 blah. And tomorrow I can give another Bhagavatam class. And according to the original Veda, the Atharva Veda, I could contradict myself and be right. In today's lecture, I could say the Yajur Veda is the additional. Tomorrow, I can say the Atharva Veda. And I could be right because I'm quoting Prabhupada in either case.
But isn't it that all the four Vedas are original?
That's another matter.
Okay.
So, I can't. That never seen it described. Only the Yajur Veda and the Atharva Veda I've seen described. So, the point is that even the great acharyas may sometimes disagree on details, but then who do we side with? We side with Prabhupada. That's all. We always side with Srila Prabhupada, and if he takes both sides, then we can have both sides. I mean, you may say, well, how is that? Well, we have to see that acharya who is more empowered than any other acharya in the history of the world for delivering us from this quagmire of material existence. Who is that acharya who was empowered to distribute Krishna consciousness all over this planet? Like no one ever dreamed was even possible. You see? We have to see, objectively analyzing, that there is no acharya as powerful, as potent as His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. So therefore, we will always follow the line of Prabhupada. Not because we got initiated at His Sampradaya, therefore we have to blindly go along with Prabhupada. No. We've accepted Prabhupada because He is that, we accept Him not blindly, but because He actually truly is the most realized, empowered Vaishnava Acharya in the history of the world. That's a bit. So we don't blindly just parrot Prabhupada. We accept Prabhupada's vision of the proper understanding of Siddhanta because He's shown that He has the highest realization of any acharya in the history of the world. See, He's shown that. Therefore, we will always side with Srila Prabhupada if there's any controversy. And if He accepts both sides, then we'll also accept both sides of an issue. It's a transcendental controversy. Transcendental disagreement. So you should always try to see and worship all the Vaishnavas. Shri Guru Vaishnava Pade Maja Iyama. Even if someone disagrees with someone who may be, you know, a great spiritual hero for you, you should not think badly about that person. You should simply think, these are transcendental controversies beyond my scope.
So, in that, beyond our scope, let us see that like the other Gaudiya Vaishnavas are trying to say so many things which is against. So, should we be very respectful to them, or what should we do?
Well, if you study carefully, just like Prabhupada's relationship with the other Gaudiya preachers, the God Brothers, and that also includes the followers of His God Brothers now as well. Concept. So, Prabhupada, on the one hand, very strongly criticized His God Brothers that they didn't follow the order of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur. They dismantled the Gaudiya Math shortly after His disappearance, fighting in the courts over who will own the properties, etc., etc. And in another purport, he will actually say, well, you know, I'm serving Guru Maharaj in my way and they're serving in their way. So Prabhupada actually does both things. But he practically he gave an instruction which is in a letter which was instruction to all of his disciples that we should not go to them, that they will harm the natural progress of this movement. So it's a principle of good fences make good neighbors, that we can appreciate that in their own way they're trying to spread Krishna consciousness. We respect them for that. At the same time, we understand that they're not always, you know, they're doing things which are against what Prabhupada has taught us. Some of the points of philosophy are different. And if we allow them to, if we accept them as authorities to come in and guide us how we should be follow Prabhupada, they will create all havoc. And some of them are trying to do that. There's one in particular, I don't want to mention his name here on this, we're being recorded, this is being broadcast on the internet within several days. So yeah, there's one very prominent one who is claiming that he's Prabhupada's successor, he's Prabhupada's sole successor, and that all of the ISKCON devotees should now take shelter of him, become his initiated disciples. You see? So this person actually disagrees with Prabhupada on many points of philosophy. On many points he says that Prabhupada is wrong. So we have to understand this, that Prabhupada warned us not to go to these persons for instruction. We should respect them from a distance, because they are, you know, according to their understanding and realization, they are trying to serve Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakura's mission. And, you know, That's a rare person on this planet who wants to follow Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakura's mission. So we don't want to, take them as enemies. At the same time, we don't want to become their students. Any other questions?
In the association of our spiritual master and his god brothers or god family, what's the proper etiquette? In serving.
Well, I know in that letter book that you're working in, there's one place where Prabhupada says that you don't have to offer obeisances to others in the presence of your spiritual master. That's Prabhupada said that.
Yeah.
That's one point. When you're with your Guru Maharaj, you don't have to offer obeisances to others, although he may tell you to, and you can do it. There's so many individual circumstances, so many unlimited variety of situations that can arise that, if we try to give you a list, it could be, 1,000 pages long. But you have to remember the example of the list. Do you know the story of the guru and the list? So one time, the spiritual master, he was traveling by horseback and his disciples were walking alongside on some pilgrimage, you see. And the spiritual master's hat fell off. Maybe it was sunny or something. He's probably wearing a hat so his shaved head wouldn't get burned with the sun. So his hat blew off and nobody picked it up. The disciples were so stupid, they just let his hat sit there and they were kept walking. Guru Maharaj stopped the horse and said, "What's this? You don't pick up my hat?" He said, "Guru Maharaj, you didn't tell us to pick up your hat. Don't you have any brains? My hat fell down." And they said, "Well, Guru Maharaj, we are less intelligent, and why don't you just give us a list of things that we would have to pick up?" So
that's
he gave...
Huh? That point he didn't give the list. There is one more step to go.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He said, "Guru Maharaj, just tell us, give us an instruction, then we'll always know what to do." He said, "Well, if something falls, pick it up. Since you don't have the intelligence to know, you should pick it up. Now I'll just give you an instruction. If something falls, then pick it up." So they went on down the way, towards the holy place, down the road. And then the horse passed stool. And the disciples went running to the stool to bring it to Guru Maharaj. And Guru Maharaj said, "What kind of disciples are you? You don't have any brains? You're going to bring horse stool to the spiritual master?" They said, "Guru Maharaj, we are really less intelligent. We sincerely want to serve you, but we really are less intelligent. Just give us a list." He said, "All right." I gave him a detailed list. It had to take 20 minutes to stop. A detailed list. So they kept walking, and they went out, they resumed the journey, and then there was a low-lying branch, and Guru Maharaj was knocked off the horse. And they looked on the list. Guru Maharaj was not on the list, so they just left him lying there, and they walked with a horse towards the place of pilgrimage. So, don't ask us for a list. You just have to try to understand the principle is that the God brothers of the spiritual master should be respected equally as your spiritual master. That's stated in Prabhupada's books. The God brothers of your spiritual master, you should respect them as on an equal level with your spiritual master.
That's what I was thinking, but that in some situations it makes you maybe I should just not do this service because I can't do it for everyone, because if there's...
Well, actually, there's not that many God brothers around.
Well, when like Gainesville there is, like in Alachua.
In Alachua there.
So, I mean, would it do, like, if you're at a big festival or something like that, that would happen.
Then you just, you can always ask Guru Maharaj if she's expert in all these practical things.
What if she's like, I don't know.
And you ask me. You, if you can't figure something out, you always can inquire from the spiritual master, from Guru Mata. You're always welcome to inquire if you can't figure something out. But the principle is you should equally respect them as you do your spiritual master.
It also depends on time, place, and
circumstances.
Time, place, and circumstances.
The main thing is you have to. You have to take your main service is to your spiritual master. He is your direct connection with Krishna, your direct connection with Prabhupada is your spiritual master. So you first and foremost have to always make sure that you're pleasing him. But if you just please, if you just serve him and neglect others, that he will not be very happy with that. That will, you have to. You have to learn how to serve and please other Vaishnavas for the pleasure of your spiritual master. Everything is being done for the pleasure of your spiritual master, actually. Just like you're traveling with us, I want to see that you're serving Guru Mata very nicely. Not that you're just serving me. So, if you're just serving me only and you're neglecting her, then you're doing a disservice for me. We see, as I've mentioned before, we see in the Krishna book how Krishna, he went to the jungle for gathering the firewood on the order not of Guru Maharaj, but on the order of Guru Mata. And Guru Maharaj was very pleased. He didn't say, oh, what did you listen to my wife for? She doesn't know anything. You're here in the forest. No, but he actually felt that you've done this for me. He took the order being, you've done all this trouble you've gone through to please me. He took the service that he had done under Guru Mata's direction as service to him. You have a Most disciples don't have this opportunity. They have a sannyasi spiritual master. You have a special, a double mercy. Having a spiritual master as a wife. Some people in this kind of say, well, how can someone be a guru if they're not a sannyasi? But they forget the seven mothers, the standard list. Who are the seven mothers? The real mother, the wife of the Brahmin, the wife of the queen, and the wife of the guru. One of the seven mothers. So obviously, the spiritual master can be married, he can have a wife, and that is mother. The wife of the spiritual master is mother. So any other questions? Alright, we'll stop here. Kantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai.